The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey folks, Ben Wittes here. This episode of Trump Trials and Tribulations was recorded on Thursday, which is to say before Judge Scott McAfee in the Georgia Fulton County matter issued his opinion on the disqualification of Fani Willis. We have done a separate recording on that subject alone, which is available right now on YouTube and will be on the Lawfare podcast on Monday. We will link to the YouTube in the show notes of this show, or you can just wait for it on Monday on the podcast feed.
On the other hand, Trump's team in this motion is saying, you know, it's the fault of New York prosecutors who should have already been getting this material and handing it over to the defense. So that's what's going on. It looks like, you know, we're still waiting to see if Judge Mershon will postpone the trial. But it seems that since the state is not opposing a delay and the defense has requested it, and there is this, you know, whoever's fault it was, there is this kind of, you know, belated discovery. Very unclear at this point why federal prosecutors handed over all of this information so late. But regardless, it's up to Judge Mershon. So we'll see what he does. But we could see a delay in the case.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 16th, 2024. It's another episode of Trump's Trials and Tribulations, recorded on March 14th in front of a live audience on YouTube and Riverside. I sat down in the virtual jungle studio with the great Roger Parloff and the great Anna Bauer to talk about the Thursday hearing in the Mar-a-Lago case and everything Judge Cannon still needs to rule on. Spoiler alert, there's a lot. We also discussed how Judge McAfee may rule on whether to disqualify Fulton County DA Fani Willis and why the New York City trial may be delayed by up to a month. And of course, we took audience questions from Lawfare Material supporters on Riverside. You should become one, and then you can ask one, and we can answer yours. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 16th. Trump's Trials and Tribulations, delays all across the East Coast. Roger, I have a string of questions for you about what happened in South Florida today. I have, I think, 7 questions for you. First of all, number one, did Judge Eileen Cannon, we had a lot of hours of hearing today, did we get a trial date out of it?
No, we did not.
Okay. Did we get a hint of a trial date?
No, we did not. At the end of the hearing, in fact, she brought up with the lawyer, she said, is there anything else important I haven't mentioned that you want to raise? And all the reporters looked at each other and said, when's the trial? And the lawyer said no, and then the hearing ended.
So do you think the lawyer said no because this wasn't on the agenda, or?
Yeah, and I think they know that she doesn't like to be nudged.
Okay. So, all right, third question. What was the first matter that she heard oral arguments on today?
It was a motion to dismiss for vagueness of the first 32 counts, which are the willful retention of national defense information. The theory is that the term is unconstitutionally vague. We can go into that more later if you want.
Unconstitutionally vague in general, because, you know, that provision has been used a whole heck of a lot against a whole heck of a lot of people. It is pretty vague, but, or at least it's broad, but it's, you know, like, it's kind of well-trodden ground since, you know, what was it, passed in 1917 or something?
Yeah, 1917. And then some sort of updating in 1950. You're right. It's unconstitutional as applied, a lot of it has to do with the fact that he was president, and so he was had some original classification authority. But mainly it's about the interaction, the interplay between the Presidential Records Act or the alleged interaction of the Presidential Records Act and the Espionage Act, which is what that 793E is.
I see. So I assume that, you know, at a minimum, she ruled on that motion.
No, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Ben. She took that under advisement.
I see. So, what was the second motion she heard arguments on today?
The second motion, which, overlaps a little, is a motion to dismiss the whole indictment based on the theory that the Presidential Records Act precludes this indictment for a number of different reasons, but primarily the idea that by the very act of removing documents from the White House to his residence, effectively was designating them as personal under the Presidential Records Act, and that once he did that, he has unfettered discretion to do that, even though classified information bears no resemblance to the definition of personal in the Presidential Records Act, and it's unreviewable, and there's no remedy except possibly civil remedies, and those are exclusive, and no criminal sanction possible.
Okay, and surely she ruled on that one.
You know, Ben, she didn't.
Okay, so did she rule on anything?
You know, Ben, she didn't. She did, however, there were interesting mixed signals. One of the mixed signals was, a couple times there's another motion pending that we weren't supposed to hear today called a motion to dismiss for vindictive and selective prosecution. And that has a couple different aspects to it. She seemed very receptive to that notion. And that sort of overlaps with the Presidential Records Act for reasons we can discuss. But the sense that no other president has been treated the way Trump has, you know, when Reagan took diaries and Clinton had these tapes of he did with Taylor Branch. And there were these minor disputes and nobody thought of, you know, raiding their homes and doing search and seizures and indicting them. And she was very receptive to the idea, at least, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean she'll dismiss on those grounds when this comes up, but it probably means she might grant discovery, which would in itself be historic. It's never happened before since 1995, I don't think. I mean, which is when a Supreme Court ruling said you have a very high standard to get that. And, but she might even grant it.
But I'm confused. That motion wasn't before her today, right?
No.
So she didn't rule in any way on that one either.
No, but there were little hints. The other intriguing hint, which went the other way sort of, was that she often would do an aside. She'd be talking about the vagueness of a certain term, or, you know, the lawyers would be talking about the alleged vagueness, and she would say, so assume if I do deny your motion, how would you define that term in the jury instructions? So that sounds like maybe she plans to hold a jury trial. So some people, we don't know when she would hold that, what year, but it sounded like...
Right, well, that would be after she would hold the jury trial, right, after she gets reversed for dismissing the case for selective prosecution,
maybe,
right?
Maybe that's the plan. But that was interesting.
So I'm still hung up on this, like, before we get to the substance of it. I'm just hung up on the fact that, you know, part of a district judge's job is to rule one way or the other on motions. And she doesn't really seem to have a sense of that as part of her job. She holds these hearings. She held one a couple weeks ago that Anna went to, and she didn't issue any rulings during or after that. And then she holds another one, and, you know, like, she has these motions that are kind of piling up and just doesn't rule on them. Did she give any hint of when she might resolve any of this stuff?
Wait, can I just break in and say that we do have some breaking news, which is that I just checked the docket, and Judge Cannon has denied without prejudice the motion to dismiss charges based on unconstitutional vagueness. So she has ruled on something.
Wow. And is there an opinion attached to that, or is it...
Is she listening to the show?
There is. I know. Maybe Judge Cannon is a Trump Trials fan. There's some impact. It looks as though there is an opinion, but I'll have to take a second to read it. It's very brief.
All right. So let us, you know, I've been making fun of her about the whole not ruling thing, and Roger has been, in his very gentlemanly way, pointing out that it's seems to be very difficult for her to put on paper in an opinion anything that is adverse to the former president. But this seems like within an hour and a half of the end of this hearing, she has watched enough of the Trump trials and tribulations to be irritated at Roger and me and want to put us both in our place. So kudos to Judge Eileen Cannon. And we're going to let Anna read for a minute.
Well, I was going to say it's brief enough. The kind of meat of the decision is brief enough that I could just read the two sentences.
Yeah.
Basically. Okay. So she says, you know, he seeks dismissal of counts 1 to 32 of the superseding indictment based on grounds that the statutory phrases are unconstitutionally vague. And then she says, although the motion raises various arguments warranting serious consideration, the court ultimately determines, following lengthy oral argument, that resolution of the overall question presented depends too greatly on contested instructional questions about still fluctuating definitions of statutory terms/phrases as charged, along with at least some disputed factual issues as raised in the motion. For that reason, rather than prematurely decide now whether application of 18 U.S.C. 793C in these circumstances yields unsalvageable vagueness despite the asserted judicial glosses, the court elects to deny the motion without prejudice to be raised as appropriate in connection with jury instruction briefing and/or other appropriate motions.
I see. So that is not quite a denial of the motion. That's a bring this back to me in the context of how to instruct the jury.
And I would expect a very similar thing with respect to the other motion. She was saying that that was premature also because it hinges on factual issues.
It's also just kind of a word salad, to be honest. It's not, that was basically two sentences. And
it's two very long sentences.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to come back to Judge Cannon in a little while. But first, we have breaking news out of New York, which is that the government, that now this is the state government, or the county, New York County prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, has acceded to an up to 30-day delay in the Stormy Daniels election interference hush money case. So, Anna, you have done a crash course on the issue that led to this delay. What is going on in New York, and what should we expect to happen?
Right. So remember, we're supposed to be starting jury selection in this trial on March 25th. And Judge Mershon, who's the presiding judge in the case, has previously rejected requests by Trump to delay the trial. The last time that I was at a hearing in Fort Pierce before Judge Cannon, Todd Blanche, who is also Trump's counsel in New York, said that he believed that the March 25th date was a pretty firm one. But then that all changed a bit today when we had this filing from Alvin Bragg's office in which they told Judge Mershon that they'd be willing to, consent to, or at least not oppose, a up to 30-day delay of the trial. The reason being is that it all relates to some discovery issues that are and records that were kind of belatedly produced by federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. So just for background here, according to this filing from Alvin Bragg, back in June, about 9 months ago, there was a production of discovery from the prosecutors in the Southern District of New York who previously prosecuted Michael Cohen for campaign finance violations. And as a result of that prosecution, because Michael Cohen is expected to be a witness in this case, there were a number of things that Alvin Bragg and that Trump's team had requested, including, you know, grand jury materials and various reports and witness statements that relate to that prosecution, bank records as well. So various different materials that they requested from prosecutors in New York at the federal level. Prosecutors, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but they didn't turn over all of the requested materials.
That's
to
the federal prosecutors, to be
yes,
precise.
Yes, the federal prosecutors did not turn over all of the materials that were requested by Alvin Bragg's office. Those are the state prosecutors. And then a few months went by. According to Alvin Bragg, the defense, Trump's team, did not, you know, request additional materials until much later. Finally, in January, they subpoenaed the Southern District of New York to try to get some of these additional materials that were not initially turned over. And then as a part of that subpoena, apparently Trump's team consented to several delays in the deadline for production from the Southern District of New York. So since March 4th, there's been, I think that it's something over 70,000 pages of records that were turned over from prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. And then Alvin Bragg's filing also reveals that there were 31,000 pages turned over yesterday, and federal prosecutors estimated they would have an additional production next week. Although Alvin Bragg's office has said that only a fraction of those materials are relevant to the subject matter of this particular prosecution of Trump, they said, you know, in light of this late production, even though we don't feel that we've done anything wrong in terms of our discovery obligations, we would not oppose a 30-day delay in the trial. This also comes as a response to a motion that Trump's team filed very recently in which they asked for dismissal of the charges or a 90-day adjournment of the case based on these alleged discovery violations. Although Alvin Bragg is saying this is all the fault of Trump's team who delayed, were dragging their feet on subpoenaing these records. They granted extensions On the other hand, Trump's team in this motion is saying, you know, it's the fault of New York prosecutors who should have already been getting this material and handing it over to the defense. So that's what's going on. It looks like, you know, we're still waiting to see if Judge Mershon will postpone the trial, but it seems that since the state is not opposing a delay and the defense has requested it, and there is this, you know, whoever's fault it was, there is this kind of, you know, belated discovery. Very unclear at this point why federal prosecutors handed over all of this information so late. But regardless, it's up to Judge Mershon. So we'll see what he does. But we could see a delay in the case.
So the Trump people have asked for an adjournment, as in wait for the Supreme Court, or in the alternative, adjourn for 90 days, which amounts to the same thing.
Well, yes, there's that motion.
But,
that's
but
a
this
separate
is a separate motion,
but yes.
It's two separate motions for adjournment, one with a specified period of time because of this issue, one tied to the Supreme Court's consideration of the immunity question. The government has responded they wouldn't oppose a delay of up to 30 days, though they're ready to go to trial on the 25th as planned. And so at this point, there's nothing compelling Mershon to push the trial from the 25th. He just has what amounts to, at least for the first 30 days of a delay, an unopposed motion, right?
Right. That's right. And, you know, it's, I think that it would not be unreasonable for him to order a slight delay in the case, considering that there is, as expected by SDNY, there may be an additional production of materials next week. And so he could very well, you know, say that there is reason to have a short delay in the case for that reason.
All right. So before we go on, I would be dilatory if I did not mention that we have a new resource page up on Lawfare with all the New York trial materials, all the analysis that we've done, all the docket materials. We're still assembling some of the docket materials. So, you know, that is a little bit of a work in progress, but there's a lot of docket materials there. It has a lot of our past discussions of the matter. And so we now have four resource pages, one for each of the trials. I know that some of you guys on this show have asked for a resource page on the New York case, and we said we would do it. I just wanted to let you know it is all done. And yes, to the person in the chat who is asking whether the Georgia docket is still down, you know, we are keeping our Georgia page as up to date as we can, as we get material from, you know, often by hand from lawyers involved in the case and other reporters and that sort of thing. We are keeping the page as up to date as we can. But yes, the Fulton County docketing system is the subject of a malware attack or a ransomware attack and is still not back up and functioning. And so we are doing what we can to keep our docket as up to date as we can, but we're missing stuff and we will not be able fully to correct it until we can see the docket itself. Is that fair, Anna?
That's fair.
All right. So before we go back to South Florida, let's talk a little bit more about this delay. Assuming it turns out to be a delay, do we know Justice Mershon has a very limited window in which to act, right? Because it's the 14th now. That means it's 11 days before the jury selection is scheduled. He's got to kind of act like tomorrow or the next day or, you know, Monday in order not to cause a certain amount of havoc, right?
I think that's right. I will say that as a part of this newest filing from Alvin Bragg, Bragg asked for, because I mentioned that all of this is something of a response to these developments dealing with the discovery and these kind of belated productions by SDNY. Then there was the motion to dismiss from Trump's team based on these discovery issues. And Alvin Bragg's team was supposed to respond to that motion to dismiss and delay by March 15th, I believe it was. And they've asked for a extended March 18th deadline to more fully reply to that motion. So it may be that Judge Mershon wants to find out a little bit more information about exactly what went on with these discovery issues and the kind of why of it all and what the state's response is. But I think you're right, Ben. I'm inclined to think that he will want to rule very soon on this matter, just because, you know, if he waits until the 18th, that's basically a week before jury selection is supposed to start. So I think we'll see something happen very quickly here.
All right. Let's go back to Judge Cannon's court. I want to say Baby Cannon is over there, and he is quite annoyed at his distant cousin, Eileen Cannon, and, you know, asked me to emphasize that they are not, like, first cousins or anything. He actually doesn't know her very well. And so, Roger, let's talk about this first motion, which she has now denied. With the caveat that you have not had time to read the opinion that she issued, you did presage it pretty precisely with your account of her concerns. So what is the issue, and how does it work folding it into a jury instruction issue?
Well, it's a good question about the jury instruction issue. And I'm a little surprised that that's the one she ruled on first, because she kept saying the other one was premature, because you need this particular finding. I didn't know that she was going to take the same approach with the 793E motion. But in any case, the gist of it is that they claim that there are three sections of the statute that are unconstitutionally vague. And as you mentioned, Ben, all of them have some case law saying, no, it's okay, it's not unconstitutionally vague. And the key one is a 1941 Supreme Court ruling. So what they do is they basically say, well, there since that 1941 ruling, there was a more recent Fourth Circuit ruling upholding the law, but there's nothing in the 11th Circuit. And then in 2019, the Supreme Court struck down a different law, an unrelated law, in United States versus Davis. It's something like the Career Armed Criminal Act. It's not exactly that. And the theory is, if you look at the way the court is interpreting these things now, that changes everything, and you can no longer trust Gorin, and the 11th Circuit hasn't ruled, so you can do this. It focuses on three aspects of the statute. Unauthorized possession. So the crime is having unauthorized possession of national defense information. You willfully retain it and fail to turn it over to the person entitled to receive it by law. And so they say this unauthorized possession, it's vague in part because they have a theory, which is the other motion, that he is entitled to possess it under the Presidential Records Act. Another theory is that he can just designate it as personal, even though it isn't, and that's unreviewable, And so that's unclear. Another theory is that unauthorized possession isn't defined in the act. And the definition is provided in an executive order, executive order 13526, which is the operational, or at least during his administration was the operational. I think it's still operational executive order. And so there's a legal theory that the definition has to be in the statute itself. Then there's a objection to the phrase relating to national defense. And courts have also, there's a ton of law upholding that. And in part, they've upheld it by adding a judicial gloss that this means closely held national defense information.
There is, for those who are interested, there is a huge amount of material on Lawfare about this issue in the context of other cases, and you can find a lot of information about this around the site.
And then the final phrase is entitled to receive. He says, and this again goes back to the Presidential Records Act. Their theory is that under the Presidential Records Act, once he declares it personal, and that nobody can challenge that, even though it's not personal, then there is nobody who's entitled to receive it from him. I mean, he doesn't need to give it to anybody. So that's sort of the theory. And they were hoping that the current court would maybe be less receptive to. There's some language in this Davis decision that, you can't always be, the idea is you can't always be adding these judicial glosses on your own in order to save a statute. You can't rewrite the statute. There's some language to that effect. This ruling they're relying on, it was a 5-4 ruling in 2019, and it was actually the four liberals. At that time, there were four liberals plus Gorsuch who were in the majority. All the conservatives were opposed it. I don't know if that means anything, but anyway, that was the theory of that.
Right. So now you backload this to a jury instruction.
Yeah.
How does that work? What's the jury instruction question? That if you put all this weight on how you instruct the jury, and she says basically I'm sympathetic, there's a lot here, but it's premature. What is she asking them to suggest in the way of a jury instruction?
I think she was concerned about what do I tell them with respect to unauthorized? What's the definition of unauthorized? There was also a weird thing about entitled to receive. And then Jay Bratt for the special counsel's office was saying, that's not really a part of this prosecution because he didn't return it to anybody. That would be a part if he returned it to the wrong person or, he turned it over to somebody not authorized. But so I don't know what happens there. It was confusing, and there wasn't really a lot of specifics about what the jury instructions would be. I think there was another issue about whether you need to charge something about that the way the defendant acted could cause potential harm,
could disadvantage the United States or advantage some foreign power, right?
Yeah, and Bratt was odd about that. Bratt sort of brought that up, and then the judge asked, "Well, what would you instruct there?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to say right now. I want to." And all of us wondered, "What does he mean? Is there going to be some evidence that we don't know about that's coming in?" But then it sounded more like he just had to huddle with some people at DOJ and figure out what their current position is on this jury instruction. But I really wasn't clear on that, and I don't think anyone else was. And Judge Cannon was a little irritated that he couldn't answer the question.
So what about the second? What's the second issue is this PRA question, and what's the nature of that argument?
Yeah, well, this is this argument that part of it is, I mean, the thrust of it is that, and see, she's right that there's a factual dispute involved here about whether Trump designated these documents as personal under the PRA. There's no evidence he did so far. It's not in the indictment, certainly. The indictment doesn't allege it. And that's how you do a motion to dismiss. You're usually confined to what's inside the indictment. And their theory was that by the very act of carrying documents out of the White House, you have to assume that he was designating them as personal. And the only basis for that was a comment made at a hearing, I think in March of 2012, by a government lawyer in a different case involving different facts, a case brought by Judicial Watch, which is, we'll just say a third party, that wanted to get access to tapes that Clinton had made during his administration by the historian Taylor Branch. And these tapes were made with an eye to doing a book, doing a memoir, maybe having him do a memoir. He wrote a book eventually based on these tapes. And it wasn't a document made to advance the duties of the president. It was something made with an eye to a memoir. So he took them out. So this third party, Judicial Watch, wanted the tapes, and they sued NARA. They didn't sue Clinton, they sued NARA. And NARA makes a determination, say, you know what? They sound personal to us. They're sort of the functional equivalent of a diary. But they sue anyway, and the judge, Amy Berman Jackson, a good judge, denies the motion, but there's some broad language in there. And she says, well, we certainly, you can't have a third party suing NARA for records it doesn't have and that it thinks are personal and forcing me, having me order them to call them presidential and then order them to order him to return them. But there's also language in there that we're not even sure NARA has the right. We're not even sure NARA has the right to second guess the president. You know, this might be the statute seems to be sort of the honor system. I don't know if this is reviewable. There's language like that. Now, it's a district court ruling, but that language exists, and they're sort of relying on that. And at a hearing, a government attorney, an attorney for NARA, says sort of offhandedly, well, you know, when Clinton took these tapes off the premises, presumably he was designating them as personal. And that's basically
Trump's theory.
That's the crux of how this doesn't require new fact-finding. It's a given. As soon as you walk it off, and the government is stopped from saying otherwise, as soon as you take it out of the White House, it's assumed personal, or at least that's how it was until it was Trump. And that's how it was for, you know, since George Washington, and until it was Trump, nobody cared. But now that it's Trump, they indict him and they seize his record. And so, you know, it's really selective prosecution, but
it's with a different legal gloss. Okay. So let's put aside the selective prosecution gloss to it and focus on the PRA gloss, because that's actually what this motion says.
Yeah.
Your sense is that this is going in the this is premature direction too?
Yes. Some sort of, you know, if it's possible to deny without prejudice, I don't think it really is, but yeah, that this too, and, you know, this could lead to jury instructions. You know, if she takes seriously this theory, she instructs them, there's a lot of decisions to be made here. If she instructs them, yeah, you know, he does, there's a theory out there that he has unfettered discretion to designate these personal, even though they aren't personal, you know, if you follow the definitions, that's a reasonable doubt right there. And, you know, that could make it into the, it's also, it could be a directed verdict of acquittal. So I don't know how it plays out. You don't need to win this motion to dismiss for this to remain a pretty important issue in the case. And it's right. Not just, in fairness, I mean, there was another dispute with Reagan, who was the first president under the, or former president after the PRA was enacted. It involved his diaries. I think it's pretty clear his diaries contained at least some classified information. And, you know, yeah, I don't remember the exact...
It contained a lot of classified information. The diaries were eventually published after the classified material was removed. But this is a big argument in the Biden-Her matter as well, that the Justice Department acceded to Reagan's claims that these were personal papers. Yeah. The difference is they were not government produced material. They were literally his personal diaries.
Yeah, and diaries are, you know, the PRA mentions diaries and the functional equivalent of diaries specifically as personal. But there is this problem of what about personal records that contain classified information? It's possible that Clinton's papers also contain tapes. Also contained classified information. It's a non-trivial point.
Right. Although, you know, one difference, of course, is that the government didn't demand it back. And so it seems to me where Trump's case is really different from these others, Reagan's diaries had classified information in it. For some reason, the government didn't really care, and just they stayed at Simi Valley or the Reagan ranch, and they just stayed there. Here, you do have this situation where NARA requested the material to be returned, and Trump then lies and cheats and steals to prevent them from being returned. And of course, those are the after the first 32 counts. But, you know, this case is non-trivially an obstruction case, not just a willful retention case, right?
Yeah. And it's a really important point in terms of prosecutorial discretion. You know, there's just this huge gap between what Trump did and what anyone previous to him did. But she does not seem open to understanding that. And in fact, early on, Emil Bove was making his presentation for Trump on one of these issues. And she interrupted and she started to say, let me get this clear. The crime, as the government defines it, was complete on January 21st, 2021. One day out, if he has the documents at Mar-a-Lago, he's guilty of this crime, right? And I think the question confused both because it was a little out of left field. And then eventually, I think she says it also with Jay Bratt, and he tries to say, well, yeah, but he wasn't indicted, you know, on January 21st. He was indicted, you know, years later after months of you know, shilly-shallying and turning over 15 boxes and then, you know, evading a subpoena. And she wouldn't really have it. You know, she said, no, but the crime was completed on January 21st.
I think Jay Brett answered that question wrong, because the element of willfulness, to willfully retain classified information, right? The indictment doesn't say he intentionally hoarded this material. There's evidence in the way this material was initially retained that he personally knew there was classified material in those boxes and he hid it from blah, blah, blah. The indictment says a bunch of trucks left the White House with boxes that he had helped pack, or he had, that contained a bunch of stuff that,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
that he caused them to be packed. And you don't know that it is willful. The evidence, part of the evidence that it's willful is the fact that he went through such contortions to retain it later. But I don't think it's obvious that the crime is complete on January 21st.
I think he said something like, yes, if you could prove willfully, if they conceded that he knowingly did this, then yeah, it would be complete. But we didn't charge it then. You know, we didn't charge it until, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt accumulated, basically. And that is the right answer. And she doesn't seem to, she's saying, but you didn't do that to Reagan, and you didn't do that to Clinton, and you didn't do that to Biden. I think we're headed in a scary direction.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right. Before we go to audience questions, let's go to Fulton County, Georgia, where we had a big day yesterday and we're expecting a big day tomorrow. Anna, first give us a little summary. We did a whole podcast on this today, so we're going to go light on the loss of six charges, but give us a little bit of an overview of the six charges that disappeared on a special demurrer.
Right. So we as you said, you know, we spoke about this at length on a podcast that folks can listen to for more detail. But basically, these charges that were quashed by Judge McAfee earlier.
You have
this
the opportunity
week.
Here to use the word quashel. Don't pass it up.
Quashel is, and it's been a word that I think really has been popularized by the Fulton County case because it came up earlier in the proceedings during various attempts to fight subpoenas by Lindsey Graham and others. But Judge McAfee did quash these various counts that all relate to a single type of charge. It's solicitation of soliciting a public officer to violate their oath of office. It relates to six counts of that particular charge. Three of those counts were against Trump. That it related to various different types of conduct with respect to Trump. So one was the Raffensperger phone call. Another is a phone call that he made to former Georgia House Speaker David Ralston. Another is a letter that he wrote to Raffensperger even well after Joe Biden's inauguration, in which, you know, he asked him to decertify the election. So that's what it related to with Trump. And then also there were three other counts of this particular charge that related to Giuliani, Bob Chili, and Ray Smith, and John Eastman as well. And so these counts were basically struck from the indictment. The reason being it did not relate to, you know, whether or not the evidence was sufficient to make out a crime. Instead, what Judge McAfee was focusing on here is whether the indictment was drafted with enough detail to really put the defendants on notice of what exactly it is the state is accusing them of. In particular, he mentioned that the state had not cited the particular Georgia or a United States constitutional provision that of the oath that these individuals, these public officers, people like Raffensperger or Ralston, were apparently being, you know, solicited to violate. So that's what happened earlier this week. Again, encourage folks to listen to the podcast that we have on it. But the kind of upshot of all of it is that Fani Willis can seek a re-indictment, although there are some challenges to that. There are some consequences that could delay things if she does seek re-indictment. She also could seek indictment on these charges in a separate indictment. But there, again, are also some challenges there that may mean that she would not want to do that. So it's kind of unclear at this point whether she will proceed with trying to reindict on these charges. There are plenty of other counts and that would serve as the sufficient, you know, predicate acts to make out that RICO charge. Judge McAfee denied the efforts to strike the RICO charge, and the overt acts that are the defendants also tried to get struck from the indictment also remain intact. So even though the case is maybe a little bit smaller than it was previously, the case is still very much intact. And we're now just waiting to see what Judge McAfee will decide with respect to Fani Willis.
Okay, so that is what we expect tomorrow. So first question, why do we think we know this is coming tomorrow and how confident of it are we? And second question, what's your prediction?
So we know that it's coming at least by tomorrow. I guess it's still possible we could see something tonight, but I'm a little bit doubtful of that. I think maybe tomorrow morning is more likely. But we know it's coming because Judge McAfee said 2 weeks ago that he would try to decide within 2 weeks. And then he subsequently went on a local radio show where he said that he planned to stick with his timeline. He also spoke to a reporter for CNN who happened to run into him, I believe it was yesterday or maybe the day before, and indicated that he planned to stick with that timeline. And 2 weeks is tomorrow and it's Thursday. So basically tomorrow is the only day left unless we see some kind of late night order from Judge McAfee, which I think, again, is unlikely. In terms of my prediction, I think that I'm leaning towards thinking that he will not disqualify, but he may give the prosecution team a bit of a scolding or, you know, not be particularly kind about some of the, you know, conduct here. But I do think if I had to place a bet on it, I would say he's not going to DQ. But, you know, even if he doesn't disqualify Fani Willis, a lot depends on exactly how he crafts this order and what his factual findings were. So even if, for example, he says, I don't think that the law supports disqualification, if he makes some kind of factual finding that the prosecution team were not fully candid or truthful in their testimony under oath, then that could make for a pretty favorable record for the defendants to go up on appeal to the Georgia Court of Appeals. They will have to request a certificate of immediate review in order to appeal before trial. I think Judge McAfee is pretty likely to grant that certificate of immediate review because this is a very unclear area of law. There's some legal issues he's going to have to rule on here. For example, the standard of disqualification. Is it actual conflict? Is it appearance of impropriety? That kind of thing. This is a fact pattern that just has really never been addressed in Georgia law when it comes to disqualification. So I feel fairly confident that because of the lack of precedent, he would be very, very likely to let the defendants immediately appeal.
Roger, you've been following the technical term is the shenanigans in Fulton County. Do you have a prediction for how Boy Wonder is going to rule tomorrow?
I think he's going to let her stay because I was impressed by the state's last brief on that, that the standard was very high. And, you know, for all the really bad stuff that happened in court, mainly, it's so inconceivable that any of this really harmed any of the defendants. You know, even if you buy the fact that she got some money back, it's such a heavy lift to say that she said, you know what, let's not drop Mike Roman from the indictment because I want to be able to pay you more and we can go to Aruba on that. I don't think that happened. And I don't think there was proof of that. So that's where I come down. But if he disqualifies her, I'll back him up because some really bad things happened.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I think it's a case that I can kind of write the opinion either way in my head. And I don't think it is a lawless thing for him to disqualify her. That said, I don't think he's going to do it. I think Anna has it almost exactly right. What we're going to see is he's going to take the issue seriously. He's going to bank on the high standard. He's going to assume a lot of facts in the light less favorable to her without ruling on those facts, without making findings of fact. And he's going to say that even if we assume X, Y, and Z, it doesn't reach the very high standard in Georgia case law. And that way he doesn't have to say he believes her or he believes Nathan Wade. Interesting subsidiary question is whether he'll disqualify Nathan Wade, on which the matter is a little bit less close. I actually think the case for disqualifying Nathan Wade is pretty good.
Yeah, I will say though, I will not be surprised if he does disqualify her. I think that, separate from whatever it is that I think about what he ought to do, I will, knowing Judge McAfee, I would not be surprised if he disqualifies her.
I would be mildly surprised, but I think if I were betting, I would say it's a 70-30 no disqualification. But would I be shocked? As Roger says, I would defend him if he did it. I don't think it's a lawless thing to do. I don't think it's a partisan political thing to do. I just think the better argument is in the other direction. All right. We are going to go to audience questions. There are 17 of them. We're going to get through all of them. So we're going to do quick questions, quick answers. Most people seem to want me to read them. So I will read them unless people specifically request otherwise. Nancy asks, What is your collective best guess as to how long Trump can keep these multiple cases going? Is it known if he has paid his many lawyers up front? So those are two very different questions. And I will just say on the first one, it is really up to the courts how long he can keep this going. All of these cases have reasons why they are, you know, complicated to bring to trial in a quick fashion. And the courts can make those, can sweep that off the table, or they can indulge in it. And he's got courts that are cautious and are therefore indulging it to a certain degree. As to the money, this is just, you know, I don't give legal advice to listeners, but I just want to say, if y'all ever get in trouble with federal prosecutors, it's super good to have a political committee that basically you control and you can put your daughter-in-law in charge of. And actually, when your children are picking people to marry, urge them to pick people who you could install at the head of a political committee if you ever get in trouble with the feds, because those political committees are really good for paying your legal bills. And you can drag things out a lot longer if you have a national political committee, a party committee that can pay all your legal bills for a long period of time. You know, $50 million, it can get costly to do four defenses at the same time. But if you control a party committee, you can really defray the cost in substantial ways. So just keep that in mind for all your future criminal endeavors. Anna, Roger, do you have stuff to add on how long Trump can drag this out?
Just about the being paid up front. Most criminal lawyers get a sizable retainer up front. I think we do know that Chris Kyes got $3
million. They got $3 million, up front. Yeah.
And he's, if I'm reading the disclosures properly, he seems to be continuing to get sums of money. I don't know if those are reimbursements for expenses or new legal fees. But the trick is always that it's very hard to predict how much you're going to put into a case. And once you get in, you can't get out without permission of the judge. So it's a tricky business.
Although in Trump's case, a lot of people get out unwillingly because they get fired. So Roger, when you commit federal criminal offenses, do you seize control of a party committee first, or do you do that after when you start getting the legal bills?
My practice has been to wait for the bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mine too. All right. Catherine asks, footnote 8 of McAfee's ruling speaks to the inconvenience to future grand juries for something so easily remedied. Since Georgia law does not allow for a bill of particulars, how easily remedied will the grand jury process be if the DA goes that route? Anna, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, so usually, I mean, my understanding of this is that it actually is a bit of an inconvenience to a grand jury who would consider this case. The reason being that there's not such thing in Georgia's state law as a superseding indictment as there would be in the federal system, where, you know, you have your original indictment and then you just kind of focus on the supplemental charges. It's called a re-indictment instead, and I think that they have to present the entire case over again, which is different from how you would maybe do it in the federal system that is a little bit more streamlined. I think he mentions that at one point in one of those footnotes. But the other thing as well is that, and he mentions this in a footnote, I don't know if it's the same footnote, but he talks about how Georgia law requires the names of the grand jurors on the indictment itself. So if folks remember when Trump and others were initially indicted, the document had the names of the grand jurors on there. McAfee, though, subsequently allowed redaction of that document. So I think that he mentioned on there something about, you know, with the appropriate motion, I would grant redaction of those names on the indictment. I think that those two issues kind of summarize the reasons why it might be more challenging in Georgia specifically to reindict. It's not a totally simple process.
If she doesn't reindict, can the phone call to Raffensperger, will that still come in under other counts?
Yeah, so it comes in both under the RICO count, which, you know, it goes to, it's an overt act, it's goes to, you know, proving the conspiracy and all that. But then also it is separately indicted under count. I can't recall which count it is, but he is indicted for that call as a discrete crime related to false statements that were made within the jurisdiction of the state, the jurisdiction being, you know, and speaking to the Secretary of State, an election officer of the state. And there were several false statements that were made on that phone call. We spoke on the podcast about how, you know, maybe the soliciting a violation of oath of office goes a little bit more than that false statement charge to really kind of expressing the harm of what occurred during the call, in that, you know, a president is using his power to try to convince a state election official to, you know, do something that is improper or unlawful. And so there's something that is, I think, lost as a kind of communicative aspect of the charge with these counts being dropped. But it still is there in the RICO count, and then it's also there in those discrete false statement charges.
Yeah, and there's actually a paragraph of the opinion where Boy Wonder says specifically that the fact that he is striking the particular charge does not preclude its presentation as part of the RICO allegation. Kevin writes in with a question that I absolutely love, and it relates to something that I said a couple weeks ago, and this is concerning the Colorado case. He writes, given that states have nearly complete discretion on how they apportion electors in presidential elections, including avoiding popular votes altogether, could Colorado pass a law saying that the state's electors will be given to the top vote-getting candidate who has not been adjudicated by a Colorado court to be an insurrectionist? Roger, this one, I mean, it's a very elegant formulation of the question, of the point that I made the other day, which is, you know, what gives? They could assign the thing to the shorter candidate. Why can't they consider insurrection in assigning this? What do you think? Could they get away with this?
You know, a week ago, somebody asked a hypothetical about changing state constitutional law, and I brushed it off. And then somebody advised me that Akil Amar had mentioned on his podcast that they could do that. So I'm not going to take a stab at that one. It's a very interesting hypothetical. I'll just leave it there.
I will take a stab at it. So this is exactly the point that I was trying to make a couple weeks ago. It's actually better formulated than the version that I said. And the answer to your question is no, they wouldn't get away with it for precisely the reason they didn't get away with this, but that it shows the incoherence of the Supreme Court's ruling, right? That if you take the Electors Clause seriously and they can really say Colorado will assign its electoral votes to Donald Trump or to the Republican candidate or to the candidate with longer eyebrows or bushier, or maybe to the one with one white eyebrow and one brown eyebrow, you know, if they can do that, surely they can also say, logically, they could also say, we will assign our electors to the guy who gets the most votes who didn't happen to have violated Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But the Supreme Court just said, no, they can't do that. And I do think that is incoherent given the list of things that they indubitably can do. And so I would say, no, they won't get away. They wouldn't get away with this under this opinion. But one of the problems with this opinion is it really doesn't make clear why they shouldn't get away with that. And I do think, you know, Kevin's question illuminates that intellectual deficit in the opinion very elegantly. And it was exactly the point that I was trying to get to, whether it was last week or the week before, I'm not sure. But Kevin's formulation of it is better than mine. All right. Two questions from Supergiant Robot. The first question, if I recall correctly, a legal analyst explained that if a canon decision were reversed by the appeals court, the special counsel could petition at that time for her to be replaced. How often is such a request made by either party, and how often are the requests granted? So let me take a crack at this. So the answer is, if there were a canon ruling that were so outrageous as to permit a mandamus petition to the 11th Circuit. And remember, the 11th Circuit is itself a very conservative court. And mandamus is a disfavored way to resolve interlocutory matters. So you'd have to imagine that she had done something really awful. In the context of asking for a remedy, like reversal, ordering her to do the right thing, you could imagine the Justice Department or the special counsel saying, and please, by the way, when you reassign this, assign it to a different judge, because this judge is clearly biased, as evidenced by the following pattern of activity dating back from before this case was indicted. Now, how unusual would that be? Really unusual. like that is not a... I'm trying to think of a case where that I've seen that's happened. There was a case a number of years ago where Judge Lamberth, where the D.C. Circuit reassigned a case after repeatedly reversing Judge Lamberth, if memory serves. It's really rare, and I don't think it's... I don't think we should be looking for that to happen here. It's unlikely, and it would require something not just wrong, but crazy wrong on her part in order for the Justice Department to take that step, much less for the 11th Circuit to grant it.
I agree with that. I just noticed, I would add that she is conscious. You know, one thing that can, as Ben said, that will get that you reassigned is recalcitrance. If you're reversed and then you try to get around that original ruling. And so one thing that Jack Smith mentioned to her is that there is one 11th Circuit case that holds that Executive Order 13526, that's the one that enforces the classified information rules, applies, quote, equally to former presidents unless the current administration in its discretion chooses to waive them. And that, of course, is the 11th Circuit ruling in Trump versus United States from September 2022. And I think she's got that well in mind about not, you know, giving them an opportunity to reverse her again.
And look, she can do a huge amount of damage in a fashion that is unreversible. And, you know, one of them is by instructing the jury in ways that are mischievous. You define terms to a jury. There's no way the 11th Circuit's going to intervene in that. Right. Another way is a directed verdict. These are unappealable. And so, you know, one of the questions is, if you assume that she is corrupt, which is the assumption of this question, I think, is she competently so, or is the malevolence tempered by incompetence? And, you know, those are two very different forms of bad behavior in a district judge. It's competently bad behavior and incompetently bad behavior. All right, second question from Supergiant Robot. If I am a sitting juror in the New York City criminal trial, what will I be asked to decide? That Trump interfered with the election by falsifying documents, that he falsified documents, or both? I guess I'm asking, what is the story that Mr. Bragg will be trying to tell to the jury? Which of you wants to take that?
I can take that. What he will try to tell them is that very soon after he declared his candidacy in 2015, July, in August, he had a meeting and he met with Michael Cohen and David Pecker of the parent company of the National Enquirer, and they made an agreement to try to catch and kill adverse stories and to so that these wouldn't harm him during the election. And the key ones that he's charged with because of statute of limitations problems, these included payoffs to three people. The first person was a doorman who was probably, I think everyone agrees he was lying. His story was false. Second was Karen McDougal. The third was Stormy Daniels. All of the payments, the 34 counts, relate to invoices, checks, and ledger entries relating to falsely characterizing those as his legal expenses rather than a payoff. And it came just this ones to Stormy Daniels came, I think, in October 2016, just before the election. So, yes, the falsification of documents is the base charge. That would be a misdemeanor, but it becomes a felony if you do it to commit another crime. And that other crime can be campaign-related crimes. That could be a federal campaign violation, like the kind that Michael Cohen pled to. And it could also be state tax crimes having to do with, there are some other things.
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, the story Bratt is trying to tell, or will be trying to tell, is that Donald Trump and his colleagues conspired to squash a story in the run-up to the election and falsified business records to cover up that effort. I think that's the basic story. Jeff asks, the bar on prosecuting a sitting president is based on an OLC memo, not on federal law or constitutional amendment. It stops the DOJ from acting, but what stops a state from prosecuting a president for criminal conduct, especially if the president has already been charged by a grand jury? So the answer to that question is it is unclear. OLC takes the position that the Supremacy Clause prevents the states from interfering with with the conduct of the presidency, but the courts have never had occasion to look at that. And so if you imagine that President Trump were elected and inaugurated despite having a Georgia or New York case pending against him, I assume that the state in question would yield to the federal claim, but you might have a local prosecutor who declined to do that, in which case you would presumably have some kind of a adjudication of that. I don't bet against the federal supremacy clause on that one. Jeff also asks, Trump's felony trial happens at the same time the Supreme Court gets amicus briefs and holds oral argument on presidential immunity. And if convicted, he only avoids jail by appealing, likely on claimed immunity grounds, while the court is deliberating on that very issue. What will a risk-averse court do under this enormous pressure, and is there enough popcorn for Lawfare material supporters? So I don't know the answer to that question, and nobody else does either. That will be up in the first instance to Justice Mershon. If there is a conviction, do you impose a sentence? Do you stay it pending appeal? which would coincide with the election, so it would kind of let the electoral process play out? Or do you take the position, yeah, I don't do that for anybody else. Donald Trump is a private citizen convicted of 33 or whatever felonies in my court. We're going to impose sentence and treat him like anybody else. I think that's a really personal decision in the first instance that involves the inclinations and character of the individual jurist. And I don't know Justice Mershon at all or his jurisprudence well enough to have any prediction about that. In the second instance, I think you should imagine that Trump would engage in some kind of a collateral attack in the federal courts on it. I'm not exactly sure what the mechanism of that would be. It doesn't sound in traditional habeas, but he's not going to just like march off to jail in the middle of the campaign and not try to take it to federal court. So you're going to have some, if that were to happen, either in New York or Georgia, you're going to have some dramatic federal court showdown. All right. Jared asks, I understand that trials are expensive. That's correct. Especially when there are four ongoing at once and when at least one requires extra steps such as the use of a skiff. But even with that, where does $50 million go on legal services? So, Roger, you've been a private practice attorney at one point in your life, as well as a prosecutor. How do you spend $50 million on legal fees?
Well, I practiced 40 years ago when, you know, $50 million was an unimaginable sum. And
now it's like you're $50 million here, $50 million there. Pretty soon you're talking real money.
Yeah. I don't know. It's not really impossible to me at this point with the number of lawyers, you know, squadrons and the fees involved and the travel and the I don't doubt that the billing is par for the course. It mounts up.
All right. Julia asks, Seth Abramson has a Substack post about the money coming from Chubb to post Trump's bond. Chubb CEO's father apparently has significant ties to Russian intelligence. I've seen no reporting in the media on what could be the national security risk. Does anyone at Lawfare have any information on this? So I'm going to be real careful about how I address this because I've read nothing about where that bond comes from in mainstream press that I am inclined to rely on. That said, anytime you have somebody who is cash-strapped, and Trump is clearly cash-strapped, posting $90 million. And by the way, he's going to have to post another $450 million or something in the not too distant future. And that person's also running for president. You have to be asking where the money is coming from and what strings are attached to it. Or at least, if not strings attached, at least what strings are implied. That is the essence of counterintelligence. You always want to know that. Is this his money? Is this somebody else's money? And what does who have on him as a result of the expenditure of the money? And sometimes that can be very subtle. It's not, I'll give you this money if you do X. It can be much, much subtler than that. That was the essence of the Russia investigation. As one of the people who was very concerned about Russia, and who never believed in the P tape or the Prague meeting or any of the stuff that turned out to be bullshit, it was fundamentally about the money and about Trump Tower Moscow and about, you know, Paul Manafort and about Mike Flynn, right? These were fundamentally basic counterintelligence money questions. And so when you deal with big sums of money and a person in real, real need of that money, you always have to ask that question. I don't want to answer it in an irresponsible or speculative fashion, so I'm not going to. I'm just going to say we know he put up the bond, and you want to know everything you can know about where that money is coming from and who's behind it.
I would just say Chubb is a – I may be naive, but Chubb is a very reputable company. I doubt Chubb is the problem. I agree that you would want to know where the money comes from that he's putting up to Chubb.
Ian asks, how would the Supreme Court's decision on the enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment impact enforcement of the 22nd Amendment if Trump wins this year and wants to seek a third term in 2028? Could states exclude him from the primary? Would it be up to Congress on January 6th, 2029? We actually ran an article in Lawfare about this, which I would commend you to. Roger, do you have additional thoughts on it?
Well, just I think what the article, Ned Foley, is that the one you're thinking of? Yeah.
It was Ian Bassan, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, the way I understood the ruling, there was the exception was for Section 3, and that it was like it was good for one trip only, and it doesn't apply, didn't seem to apply to Section 22 or being 35 years old or anything else. That's how I understood it.
All right. We are actually out of time. Roger Parloff from Fort Pierce, Florida, who clearly needs dinner. Anna Bauer from the special demurrer room of her palatial mansion, and me from the mask studio. We will see you next week, or I suspect tomorrow, for a special debriefing on Judge McAfee's disqualification ruling. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, our audio engineer. This episode is the insanely superb Anna Hickey of Lawfare. Look, folks, you know, I say it on the show, I say it, you know, you should become a material supporter to get your questions answered on the show. It's super fun. You know, it's not that expensive. Just go to lawfaremedia.org/support and you click on the Patreon button. You become a material supporter and it feels so good. I'm just telling you, you will feel different after you've done it. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by the one, the only, the superbly talented Jen Patia. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who now has her piano in Istanbul. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.